Well, I remember Dagobah, summer of 83. Luke was there with Leia, some Ewoks and me. Lightsaber in my hand, glowing in the night. I'm gonna find me that man Vader, I'm spoiling for a fight.
Hello and welcome to a podcast that many would describe as garbage, but to them I say, the garbage will do. It's Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who is trying to kill a future version of himself that looks suspiciously like Bruce Willis.
Mike DiCaccio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing all right. I haven't killed Bruce Willis, I haven't killed me yet. So we'll see. We'll see how things turn out.
Yeah, just be on the lookout for a really creepy little kid who has some kind of like floaty power that is way more powerful than you think of at first glance.
Mm-hmm. But it'll be a great performance, probably.
Probably. Actually, you know who that kid grew up to be?
Some other kid.
Sonny Jim from Twin Peaks.
Yes, correct.
Anyway, that's a little off topic. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. After that, we'll move on into our featured review. This week, we are discussing the new film from director Rian Johnson, which is why we're making those Looper references in the beginning, and the eighth main film in a little-known franchise known as Star Wars. It's called Star Wars: The Last Jedi. Mike, are you excited to dig into Star Wars?
Is that even a question you have to ask?
No, it's not. Yeah, we have reviewed. This is our third Star Wars review, Mike.
How crazy is that?
I love this is an annual event for the podcast now. Just every once a year, just a new Star Wars episode. Yeah. It's pretty wild. Anyway, we'll talk about Star Wars: The Last Jedi a whole bunch later on, I am sure. Right now, we got to get into some film news. All right, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and we begin by updating a story that we told last time we had an episode of Film Bookcast. It is official. Disney has purchased 21st Century Fox for $52 billion, and this is going to have a huge impact on the industry over the next couple of years. I don't think things will happen immediately. You know, there's going to be a transitional period where all the stuff gets kind of merged over to Disney, but ultimately, I think about 5,000 to 10,000 people are looking at losing their jobs. And Disney now owns a majority stake in Hulu. They own FX and FXX. They own all the shows that Fox produced, although not the actual Fox network, to be clear. So the actual channel Fox is still a Fox property because that's mostly Fox News now.
Right.
And plus franchises like the X-Men, Deadpool, and Fantastic Four stuff, which will go back to Marvel, Avatar, The Simpsons, Alien, Die Hard, Kingsman, the rights to the original Star Wars trilogy. This is huge, man. This is huge.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about a lot of this last time. But yeah, it's kind of scary. I'm nervous to see what kind of shit Disney tries to strong arm the industry with now, because they own all of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, this basically gives them at least a minor monopoly over the course of the entire film industry. The idea is that we want more competition and more studios making more stuff because that's better for the consumer. And if Disney owns everything, they can pretty much decide how anything can happen in Hollywood. And so, one of the things that Disney has been flirting with is the idea of tiered pricing for movies, which is possibly the scariest thing of all, which is, you know, a Star Wars or a Marvel movie could cost more than another movie. Like, indie movies might get their prices slashed in half because they can't compete with the Star Warses and the Marvels of the world, which will push those smaller movies and those mid-budgeted movies out of theaters, and the theater will just be like the Star Wars and Marvel experience, basically.
Yeah. It'll be, I think, like, I remember hearing Spielberg and like George Lucas talk about this while ago.
I want to say that was like 5 years ago. Yeah, Spielberg was saying exactly that would happen.
Yeah, where going to the movie theater will now become, or, you know, he foresaw a future where that is the equivalent of going to see a Broadway show right now, where it's a big event. You go maybe once or twice a year or something like that if you're lucky, and the whole family goes and all this craziness, because tickets are $50 each or whatever it might be. Which, you know, with the kind of advent of the lounge theater kind of thing. You know, the big cushy chairs and restaurants and bars, sure, and stuff serving food in theaters. I could absolutely see that happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially with Disney now just owning everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is going, like, we don't really know how this is going to shake out for now. I mean, and, you know, certain things, like, a lot of people have been focusing on the franchise stuff, which is such a small part of what this actually is. And, yeah, some cool stuff could come out of this, like, movie-wise. Like, sure, the X-Men will be back in the Marvel movies, even though that's not something I particularly care about. And, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy might be put out unedited on Blu-ray, which, like, that would be cool. I'd like that. But, you know, overall, this just seems like a very bad move for the entire entertainment industry. And it feels like there should be some kind of law preventing this from happening.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're just like straight up are. We remember antitrust laws. If you remember all the way back to your American history class from high school, Mike.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I could absolutely see Congress, well, maybe not this Congress, but Congress eventually breaking up Disney's monopoly on everything. I know, like, you know, they recently prevented the merger of, I think it was AT&T and T-Mobile or something like that recently, the last year, or right. AT&T and Comcast or some,
yeah,
shit. I can't remember.
Like, yeah,
because yeah, it would just effectively create a monopoly. So I could see this being undone at some point.
Maybe.
So
I mean,
we'll,
I guess
we'll see.
I think it depends on how Disney structures the
yeah,
acquisition of all these properties. Like, if they keep 20th Century Fox on as like another branch of Disney, kind of like how they use, how, like, you know, Lucasfilm is their own thing and Marvel's their own thing. Like, Disney is pretty content to just let these companies run however they want to run and just rake in the money that they get from them, kind of thing.
Right.
I think that's kind of what they might end up doing with 20th Century Fox. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Like, you know, I think this will result in less movies overall, and I think that's bad, you know.
Yeah.
It's bad for the consumer, it's bad for the people who make movies, you know, because they, like, it gives them less opportunity to make stuff. And, you know, I think it's going to result in a lot more sameness and homogenization in the entire movie industry, but specifically what Disney is doing. You know, Disney's been putting out, as much as I've loved a lot of the stuff they've done, we're going to talk about a Disney thing later on with Star Wars.
Yeah.
But you know, I think the Marvel movies have done a pretty good job of being their own thing, and Star Wars has been their pretty own thing. But, like, I think we've seen with, like, their Disney originals, you know, they're just remaking their animated movies now. That's pretty much all they're doing.
Yep.
And I'm fearful that we're going to see more stuff like that moving forward instead of either original properties or original takes on known properties or stuff like that. Like, you know, if we lose out, I said this last time, but if we lose out on Ridley Scott's third Alien movie, I'll be very upset.
Yeah.
I need that last David movie in my life, Mike.
I need to know how it ends, how it connects.
But yeah, and then there's other stuff like I don't know how Disney would handle like a Kingsman 3. Like, what would they do with that? You know, that's not a Disney,
yeah,
that is so far from a Disney property that it's insane. So I think, you know, they would want some kind of Fox arm making these movies because they'll make money off of them, you know, if they put them out. But they've also talked about, like, Deadpool is, you know, a decidedly R-rated franchise at this point, you know, with the first one and second one are both going to be rated R. And they've said, I think Bob Iger was saying that it will continue, they will probably continue to be rated R, but that kind of puts into perspective, like, well, how does that fit into the Marvel, you know, ethos thing if they're merging with the Marvel universe? Because I don't think Kevin Feige wants to make R-rated movies. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this all shakes out. I just don't know. But things don't look good, I think, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at a point where us as a people will just grasp on any glimmer of hope in any in everything at this point, because, you know, like, the world's on fire. So, like, if we get OG theatrical cut Star Wars, but we also have to sacrifice artistic integrity and we have a monopoly in the entertainment industry, like, dope. Yeah, I'll take what I can get right now.
Yeah, you just summarized every article about this this merger over the last 2 weeks. Yeah. All right, so I think we can move on from that, Mike, and move on into some pretty cool news. I got a couple of directorial projects that are pretty exciting. The first of which I wanted to throw out there, Creed 2, still in the works. And a while back, we reported that Sylvester Stallone was supposed to direct the movie. Now, he was going to replace Ryan Coogler, who directed the original Creed, but he is busy working on Black Panther and probably Black Panther 2 when that starts happening. So Sylvester Stallone, I thought, was a pretty good choice to do Creed 2 because obviously he's made, you know, he's directed four Rocky movies, and he's like starred in and co-written pretty much every single one. So, like, he knows the character pretty well.
Yeah.
Sylvester Stallone knows Rocky better than anybody. But, you know, what kind of set Creed apart from the other Rocky movies is that Ryan Coogler was a distinctly black voice, and he was telling a distinctly black story. And so, you know, having sort of Stallone, this incredibly old white guy, doing it, to tell the story, you know, there's fears that it might just be a Rocky movie with Adonis Creed in it instead of what it should be, which is an Adonis Creed movie with Rocky in it, you know, which is what Creed right. was. And Sylvester Stallone has now been replaced as director of Creed 2 with Stephen Caple Jr., who is a guy who I don't know much of his work. He directed a Sundance movie called The Land in 2016, but he's a black filmmaker. And, you know, I kind of like the idea of, you know, because Coogler was another guy who directed a movie out of Sundance, Fruitvale Station, and then got the chance to make Creed. And so I like the idea of, you know, this Creed series maybe just kind of taking, like, young, really talented black filmmakers and letting them run wild with this these stories. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree. I think replacing Stallone is probably not a negative thing. No, not that he's a bad director, but I think, like you said, I feel like it would just be another run-of-the-mill, it would be the eighth Rocky movie or whatever number it's up to.
Right.
And would just feel very samey, I guess. Well, possibly. I could see that happening. I mean, I don't know, you know. So, I'm down to just give it to some upstart new director and just see what they can do with the story.
Yeah, definitely. Also, another really cool project in the works, Mike. Have you ever seen the 1947 noir Nightmare Alley?
Throughout the ages, man has sought to look behind the veil that hides him from tomorrow. And through the ages, certain men have looked into the polished crystal and seen. Is it some quality of the crystal itself? Or does the gazer merely use it to turn his gaze inward? Who knows? But visions come. Slowly shifting their form, visions come.
I have not, okay. But it sounds like I should.
Yeah, I've actually never seen it either. It sounds like a pretty cool one. And Guillermo del Toro is set to remake this movie. And I would like to point out Nightmare Alley takes place in a circus. So Guillermo del Toro working on noir in a circus, like, boom.
Oh, fuck.
I'm down. That's all I have to hear.
Yeah.
Just the idea of him working on a noir is really exciting to me. But I like this. You know, his new movie, The Shape of Water, is coming out in wide release, I think, this week. I can't wait for it. I've heard I've heard several people say it's his best movie. I've seen it at the top of a lot of top 10 lists. I'm really excited to check that out. And I hope that whatever happens next, I think this is a really interesting potential project. But I'm placing this on the shelf with the 10,000 other projects that he Del Toro was always working on. I've said many times, I don't believe a Del Toro movie actually exists until I'm watching it in the theater.
Yeah.
And it has to be like halfway over before I'm like, all right, this is...
You're not just going to get punked and it's actually a different movie.
Yeah. So as far as I know, The Shape of Water getting on all these top 10 lists is just an elaborate ruse that somebody's playing a prank on me with.
Ashton Kutcher's career is coming back with this.
This is it. He's punking the art house film world with The Shape of Water.
The fish fucking world.
The fish fucking world. But anyway, yeah, I think, Del Toro doing a noir, pretty cool stuff. And then, finally, I got one last project that's probably the most exciting out of all these projects that I've talked about today, because it's based on something I kind of know about. There was a comic that started, I think, last year, 2 years ago, called Kill or Be Killed, and it was written by Ed Brubaker, and it was happening as I was still into comics. So I read maybe the first 4 or 5 issues of this thing, and I really liked it, and I would have continued with it if I had money and was able to keep buying comics.
Yes.
But Kill or Be Killed was a really cool story. Ed Brubaker's a really cool writer, and now Chad Stahelski, the director of John Wick and John Wick 2, is adapting Ed Brubaker's Kill or Be Killed, and that's pretty fucking rad.
yeah, that's a lot of my favorite words and names in one sentence together. So I'm super down for this. And I think I read probably the same, you know, 5 or 6 issues or whatever it was.
Yeah.
The first 5 or 6 for Kill or Be Killed, and it's fucking awesome.
Yeah,
I love Ed Brubaker.
Yeah, it's such a cool story, and at some point I would like to pick up the trade paperbacks or something. And actually finish reading Kill or Be Killed. But what I read was great. And I think Stahelski making it is really cool. He's currently making John Wick 3, which is set for 2019. And he was attached to make a remake of Highlander a while back. We talked about that. But I would much rather see this anyway. I'm assuming this means Highlander is dead for now, and Kill or Be Killed is what he's working on. So excited for that. That's a cool comic. And, that's Chad Stahelski making Kill or Be Killed. And I think that wraps up our film news, Mike, for today. Obviously, the big news was Disney Fox, and then just a couple of minor things. We just did a podcast last week, so it's like there wasn't that many news stories.
We're screwing ourselves over by not waiting a month and a half between episodes.
Yeah. But on the plus side, that means we don't have to do a half-hour news segment and can talk about Star Wars a lot longer.
All right. For that reason. I like the way you look at this.
But before we get into Star Wars, Mike, we got to get into our discussions. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions. All right, it is time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
I have a handful of things to discuss today, and you were part of all of them.
Wow!
Weird.
Wild
Almost
stuff.
Like we hung out this weekend.
It's crazy, man.
Yeah, so the first movie I want to throw a quick shout out to is House, which is a Japanese horror movie. I think the Japanese title is Hausu or something
yes,
like that.
Hausu, H-A-U-S-U, I believe is how it's spelled.
There you go. Which came out in 19, you'll help me, 70?
77, I think.
All right, there we go. I definitely prepared for this, guys. but yeah, this is a movie me and you watched. You showed it to me late at night on Friday, and you did warn me it would be the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You're right. it's a fever dream for about 88 minutes, yep. I think. it's a group of young Japanese schoolgirls who go to visit one of their aunts in her countryside manor. And they're all named, like, Melody, and she plays instruments. And right. Kung Fu, and she knows Kung Fu. And it's, like, the best cheesy thing. Like, just all that kind of beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
And it's got, you know, matte paintings as its backgrounds and shitty 70s green screen effects and yep. all this wonderful silly horror stuff it's fucking weird. It was
yeah.
Yeah. All I could think of was I think we even mentioned it was from Cabin in the Woods with the and the evil is defeated scene with the at the end of Cabin in the Woods,
right? The spirit is turned into a happy frog and yeah
and like that kind of thing. I will shout out though my favorite scene, or the moment where things take the hard left turn
yep.
for the rest of the movie, where one of their friends goes missing and they go to check the well. And I think Kung Fu is the character pulls up, maybe? Or no, Fantasy. I think Fantasy.
It's Fantasy, yeah, because they don't believe her because she's into the fantasy.
Fantasy, yeah. she pulls up the rope in the well because they think maybe it's tied down there. And it's her friend's head. And her friend's head starts floating
yeah.
and bites her in the ass. And then it turns or does weird flips and spinnies and then falls cackling into the well again.
Yep.
And then it's oh, we're doing this now. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I hardcore love this movie, Hausu. I think I discovered it. I was probably 16 or 17 and I was watching TCM really late at night. And it was a TCM Underground movie, which is the TCM Underground is I think it's once a week where it's 2 a.m. and they show just some weird or bizarre, a lot of times exploitation, a lot of times it's foreign horror. And that night it was Hausu and it fucked me up so much. I recently got the Criterion Blu-ray, which is why we watched it this past weekend. I believe it was lost for a long time. I don't think people knew about it was made in 1977. I think it got a small release in Japan at the time. But then for a long time, people just didn't know about it. And then I think Criterion discovered it in the mid-2000s and re-put it out there into the world.
Wow.
And yeah, it's a wild ride. If you haven't seen Hausu, watch it. It's great.
Yeah, it's a real fun time. And then the other thing I want to discuss is this past Saturday, we went to the shitty $3 local theater in Poughkeepsie, New York,
yep.
and went to another installment of the Hudson Horror Show, possibly yes. the final installment.
Yes, it seems like they're having issues with the owner of the theater. Apparently, the fire department might want to shut the place down.
yeah,
which is no surprise.
Stuff.
Yeah,
and we got to sit through a 6-movie marathon of just kind of wonderful 80s. I think mostly 80s this time.
It was almost entirely 80s, except for the second movie, which was the 70s.
Just kind of B horror movies, and not strictly just horror. There's some a great revenge movie in there.
Yeah,
blaxploitation, and just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So we a quick rundown. We watched The Boogans.
The town of Silver City has a secret. A secret below the surface. A secret that kills.
Which highlight of the day? Rough that it was the first movie, but definitely the highlight of the day.
That was your favorite one.
Yeah, I think that was the one I had the most fun with.
Yeah, it is a really funny movie.
Yeah, it's just a goofy creature feature from the 80s where the you only see the creature really close to the lens, because I'm sure the thing for it was really small. So, like, it's one of those kind of things.
Yeah.
And then second, we watched Blackula, which I had seen before. I think this was your first time seeing, right?
Yeah, that was my first time seeing Blackula, yeah. And I, honestly, I was a little, like, I liked it. But I was a little like, it wasn't really what I expected with the movie. And so it took a little while to adjust from that. Cause it really is just a straight Dracula, movie, but you know, it's just Blackula. It's a black guy, as Dracula. But I was expecting something along the lines of like Dolomite or Black Shampoo, where it's just like, you know, like all out, like kind of crazy blaxploitation. This is like actually like a true horror movie that just, you know, plays pretty straight.
Just happens to be with black people in it, which is so silly that that's even a thing, or you know that whatever. So then, what did we watch next? What was third? Was it Savage Streets? I can't remember.
Third was Prison.
Prison. That's right.
Directed by Rennie Harlan, the director of Die Hard 2, also the director of The Long Kiss Goodnight, one of the best action movies ever made.
Why don't you just go away and come back at midnight? Shoot, hey honey.
This is a real big fucking gun. This ain't no ham on rat, pal.
What the hell are you doing?
Saving your life. I would have been here sooner, but I was thinking up that ham on rat line.
You think I can't take him? Now you probably scared the other ones away.
What of?
Headhunters, Nimrod. They don't travel alone. You're always the stupid. Did you take lessons?
I took lessons.
Oh, interesting. Featuring a baby Viggo Mortensen as one of the leads, I think.
Yes, in this movie, yes.
Yeah, and it's just about a haunted prison. It's just like a kind of the MC or a host or whatever you want to call it for the event called it just a haunted house movie, and that happens to be in a prison. And that's basically it. And it's a lot of fun. It features the southern lawyer from My Cousin Vinny, is the warden, and he's deliciously evil.
Yes, he is.
And then I guess with Savage Streets.
Yeah, that was movie number four.
Well, well, well. Look who's here. The game's over, bitch. This time you're dead for sure. First, I'm gonna fuck you. And then, I'm gonna slice you into little pieces.
Sounds nice and kinky to me. Too bad you're not double jointed.
Why?
Because if you were, you'd be able to bend over and kiss your ass goodbye.
Which is a revenge thriller starring Linda Blair, which is really cool. She's just her sister is raped by this kind of street gang, and she just goes on a murder spree with a crossbow.
Yeah.
And, like, it's pretty dope.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Pretty rad.
Then fifth was Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers.
Yes.
Which was actually really awesome. I don't think I had seen this one before. You know, not that I think you'd particularly need to see all of the Halloween movies, I guess.
Right. basically, like, because there's Halloween 1 and 2, and that kind of tells you, like, all right, that, like, Halloween 2 picks up right where Halloween takes place, right?
Right, yeah.
So that, like, basically all you need to know is, like, Michael Myers is gone now. Like, he's you know, been put away. Because Halloween 3 is entirely separate from the rest of the Halloween movies. It's a different... Like, there's no Michael Myers in that or anything. And so, yeah, this one kind of takes place 10 years later, and it's about Jamie Lee Curtis's daughter, I think, or her daughter in the movie. Jamie Lee Curtis is, like, dead during this movie, is what they say, right?
I think they say that, but I think it might be, like, I'm sure it's revealed, like, wink, wink, we were lying, so Michael Myers couldn't find her kind of things.
Maybe, because she's in, like number 6, and then she's in, like, 8 or something like that. She's in a few more.
She's in a couple. She comes back. But yeah, this and one of my favorite things about going to these kind of marathon things is, you know, opening credits start. Everyone applauds when the title card shows. And then we get to applaud, like, you know, starring Donald Pleasance. And everyone's like, yeah,
Donald Pleasance. Yeah.
Yeah. And original Halloween theme by John Carpenter. And everyone loses their fucking minds. Yeah. It's just like so silly. Yeah, it's so much fun.
Yeah. Movie 6 had like makeup effects by Rick Baker, and the audience like lost their shit. And I was like, yes.
Yeah, it's like, where are we? Who are all you people? and I guess movie 6 we're not at liberty to discuss a whole lot.
Yeah, that was the mystery movie. So we're not really supposed to reveal what that movie is on social medias and stuff like that. But if you see Mike or I in person, or DM us in the comments below, the metaphorical comments below, because this is an audio podcast.
Colin, just text me and I'll tell you what it is. yeah, but it was a classic and it was fun. They mentioned that since they think it's possible that this might be their last one, they decided to go with a bigger movie. Typically, they try to go – the mystery movies are like deep cuts or stuff, you know, that people probably haven't seen or heard of a whole lot.
Yeah.
But to kind of celebrate what Hudson Horror Show is and everything, they went with a bigger movie. And it was a lot of fun. It's a movie I had only seen once.
Yeah.
And you can find in one of my discussions this year if you
yeah, this year.
Yeah, if you are crafty. I only have one every episode, so.
So you should be able to narrow it down.
Yeah, you should be able to figure it out.
What's the one 80s horror movie that Mike watched this year? Let me go back.
Yeah, come on.
But yeah, and I had seen this movie either like senior year of high school, like freshman year of college, and I hadn't seen it since. And so yeah, it was great to just watch this movie again and kind of be taken by it and you know, relive some of that stuff with a huge like packed audience. It was kind of unfortunate that it was the last movie of the night because we were all so fucking tired.
Yeah,
you know. So at a certain point, we're just like, all right, how much longer is this? It's midnight. We gotta go home. But in any case, it was still a lot of fun. So that is the Hudson Horror Show. Hopefully not the last one.
Yeah,
you know, but if it is, it was a good one to go out on. But I think there will be. I think there will be more. It sounds like they have plans in place to keep it going as much as possible. So we'll see what happens with that. But then I have a few more movies I wanted to discuss in my discussions, Mike. The first of which is called Mudbound, which is the new Netflix original directed by Dee Rees. And this has been getting phenomenal reviews across the board. I think it has like a 97% of Rotten Tomatoes. It's about two veterans, one white and one black, who return home from World War II in the South and have to readjust back to civilian life. It includes Joel Edgerton, Carey Mulligan, Jonathan Banks is in this movie, Mary J. Blige, and it's very good. I think the first hour or so is a little sluggish, but there comes a point where it gets really, really intense, and it just doesn't let up. It's well worth checking out. Those spoilers, it's very upsetting towards the end. Things do not turn out well for pretty much anybody in this movie, and it's sad because I mean it does really well with the character work. You know, it's after that first hour, which is pretty slow. Like once the guys actually come home, you know, it's really interesting and really engaging, and you kind of fall in love with these two characters, and then things take a really bad turn, and it's very it's almost mean to the viewer.
Oh no!
But it's very powerful and well worth checking out. And then I wanted to talk about this movie called The Lore. Mike, have you heard anything about this?
No.
All right,
I don't think so.
Do the words Polish horror rock musical adaptation of The Little Mermaid sound good to you?
Yes.
100%. Yeah, this is exactly what I just described. A Polish horror rock musical adaptation of The Little Mermaid. It's directed by Agnieszka Szymoszynska. I
crushed it.
Yeah. There's a lot of consonants all in a row there. But anyway, yeah, that's exactly what this is. And it's a trip, man. It is a trip and a half. It is worth checking out. One of the weirdest movies I've watched all year, for sure.
Wow.
And then I wanted to talk about Landline, which is a new movie from director Gillian Robespierre, which is an Amazon original.
Dad's having an affair. Oh, my God. Why does he sometimes refer to himself as her Pillsbury Doughboy?
Oh, it's because he calls his junk dough?
Oh, yeah. God, just broke my brain.
And this is Robespierre's follow-up to Obvious Child, which also starred Jenny Slate. She's in this movie. And I liked Obvious Child. I thought Obvious Child was pretty good. I saw that when it was in theaters a couple years ago. And do you remember Obvious Child? That was the movie Jenny Slate starred in, kind of billed as the abortion comedy. Back then,
I remember the title and that Jenny Slate was in it, but I never saw it.
Okay, yeah. But anyway, Landline. I kind of like Landline a lot more than Obvious Child because I thought Obvious Child was funny, but Landline feels like a step up. Like it feels like it's a more engaging character piece. It's about two sisters, one who's an adult, one's in high school, and they believe their father is cheating on their mother, so they kind of are spying on him throughout the movie. It also stars Edie Falco, John Turturro, and Jay Duplass. And it's just a really funny, like, low-key movie. It's got a really engaging script. It takes place in 1995 for some reason, which is why it's called Landline. It never uses the time period for any like significant reason. It doesn't seem like there's any purpose for why it's just in the 90s. It just is.
It's trying to cash in early on the 90s nostalgia.
Maybe.
That we haven't gotten to yet. We're still on 80s right now.
Yeah, there are like, you know, bits of dialogue that reference things that happened in the 90s or whatever. Like there's one bit where somebody's watching Hillary Clinton on the TV And says something to the effect of like, wow, that's a really great suit. And then the next scene, that character is seen wearing the exact same suit. So there's like, you know, stuff like that. But otherwise, yeah, the fact that it takes place in the 90s feels very ancillary to this whole thing. But the movie's really good. It kind of reminded me of the Meyerowitz stories, which I talked about in my discussions a couple months ago. I think it's a really good companion piece to that, actually. So I just wanted to bring up Landline. It's really good. And actually, I just realized this now, but three of the four movies I've talked about today, the three that I've just talked about, all of which were directed by women.
Wow, look at you go.
I mean, I don't want to like take credit for doing that, but I'm just saying these are three really good movies directed by women if you're looking for more female directors in your life. And then finally, I have one directed by a dude, so who cares about it? It's called Tramps, which is another Netflix original.
Are you the guy?
Yeah. You the guy?
Yeah, I'm the girl.
Right. I can see that.
And it's a pretty charming, like, romantic comedy slash crime tale. And it's another, like, kind of low-key indie that Netflix picked up from a festival. I think this was at TIFF last year. And then just completely buried. Like, I feel like nobody knows about this movie. The only reason I knew about it was because I saw, like, two critics tweeting about it a while ago. Talking about it and like lamenting the fact that Netflix is burying this movie because they really liked it. But anyway, so I checked it out, and it stars Callum Turner and Grace Van Patten. Grace Van Patten was actually the daughter in the Meyerowitz stories, as two people who screw up a job and have to retrieve a briefcase they gave to the wrong person. And it's, you know, it's pretty solid. It's funny. They have a good chemistry together, and it's only an hour and 20 minutes. So, you know, it's
perfect.
Yeah. So it was a fun little lark that I wanted to throw in there. So Mudbound, The Lure, Landline, Tramps, all worth checking out. And if you can go to a Hudson Horror Show, it's well worth your time. But all out of all this, though, How Zoo is the best movie out of all the ones we've talked about today.
Correct.
So go watch How Zoo. It's fucking great. Anyway, Mike, I think that wraps up our discussions. Now let's move on into what everyone is so patiently waiting for. I assume they're waiting for. Maybe they skipped ahead. It's... It's time for our review of Star Wars: The Last Jedi.
Something inside me has always been there. But now it's awake. And I need help.
I've seen this raw strength only once before. It didn't scare me enough then. It does now.
All right, that was from the trailer for Star Wars: The Last Jedi, the new movie written and directed by Rian Johnson, and it stars Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, Daisy Ridley, Adam Driver, John Boyega, Oscar Isaac, Kelly Marie Tran, Donald Gleason, Andy Serkis, Laura Dern, Benicio Del Toro, Anthony Daniels, and Gwendolyn Christie, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Star Wars: The Last Jedi reads, Rey develops her newly discovered abilities with the guidance of Luke Skywalker, who is unsettled by the strength of her powers. Meanwhile, the Resistance prepares to do battle with the First Order. Now, Mike,
Ooh. We've
reviewed Star Wars on this podcast in the past. I don't think anybody needs to go into our enjoyment of the series, because obviously they already know. If they've listened to this podcast before, they know we're pretty huge Star Wars fans, you know, been fans of the original trilogy since we were kids. The prequel trilogy came out when we were kids, and we liked them back then, and I still kind of hold a... Like, I recognize those movies are very flawed, but I kind of enjoy watching them for some reason. Like, I've seen them many, many times. And, you know, we were both fans of Force Awakens. We both like Rogue One. What was your take on Star Wars: The Last Jedi? Actually, before we get into that, how did you react when you found out Rian Johnson, one of our favorite filmmakers, was making Star Wars: The Last Jedi?
I was very excited. I mean, we had a moment, I think, was it Friday? We were talking about like how we discovered Rian Johnson.
Yeah.
and now he and both of them were like just like some dude we heard about by accident, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I first heard about him because he used to make appearances on the Slash Filmcast way back in the day. And he hasn't in a couple of years, pretty much since he got the Star Wars job. When back in like 2009, 2010, he would just show up like every 6 months in the Slash Filmcast to like antagonize Dave Chen and like play and play the banjo in the background. And it was just, he was hilarious and he was so funny. And that got me to go watch Brick, and I was fucking blown away by Brick. It was amazing. And then when Looper came out, I was the one person I knew who was like, yeah, fucking Looper, let's go do this. And like,
yeah,
you know, but yeah. And how did you discover Rian Johnson, Mike?
I actually remember hearing about Brick when I was watching Attack of the Show on G4 TV. So that immediately tells you, like, this is like, I don't know, eight years ago, whatever.
Yeah.
forever ago. They used to do a segment called DV Tuesday, where they would review the new movies that were coming out on DVD that week. Yeah. And they reviewed Brick. And I was like, this sounds fucking dope. I got to find this movie. And I don't remember if I got it from Blockbuster or like where, or like I saw it on HBO one day, wherever I found it. I saw Brick and it quickly entered my top three movies of all time. And I've just been in love with Rian Johnson forever.
Yeah.
And The Fly is the best episode of Breaking Bad. No one can tell me otherwise.
Yes, yes. He did direct three episodes of Breaking Bad, and they are three of the best episodes of Breaking Bad. I think it's interesting you bring up Fly. Because it's one of the most divisive episodes of Breaking Bad.
Oh, well, yeah, interesting.
Right? That is a Breaking Bad episode that fans of the show either absolutely love or absolutely hate. Because he's doing something new with Breaking Bad that hadn't been done, I think, at that point. And if you look at the online reaction for Star Wars The Last Jedi, whoo, boy.
Oh, man.
People are divided about this movie. And, like, you know, I've seen, like, just outright vitriol. I've seen people say it's worse than the prequels. I've seen so much negative shit. But at the same time, like, it's getting phenomenal reviews across the board. I think it has, like, a 93 on Rotten Tomatoes. I've seen so many reactions that say it is the best since the original trilogy, possibly even surpassing the original trilogy. I was actually listening to the Slash Filmcast earlier today at their review of Star Wars The Last Jedi. Jeff Cannata said it was the best Star Wars movie. That, like, his
wow.
Jeff Cannata firmly believed it was the best one. Another critic who I really like, David Ehrlich, also had the same opinion. He thought it was the best Star Wars. I'm not going to go that far or anything, but I just think it's interesting that there's such a huge gap in the reactions for this movie. And honestly, like, I don't know how huge the amount of people are who dislike the movie. Like, I feel like it's just a very, like, loud vocal minority who are shitting all over the movie. But I think there are, like, you know, people who have, like, legitimate problems with it or stuff like that, who, you know, had criticisms that have been, like, kind of overshadowed by the people who are just shouting into the abyss about how Rian Johnson's raping our childhoods and stuff like that. There are, like, petitions on change.org to get Disney to strike The Last Jedi from the canon, which is like, what?
Yeah. Who cares? Shut your mouth. Yeah.
There's actually a petition on change.org to get Rian Johnson to apologize for The Last Jedi, which I think is hilarious. And for his part, Rian Johnson has been taking this so gracefully and so in stride, because he has a reputation for being basically like the nicest guy in Hollywood. He's like, people really love just hanging out with Rian Johnson, working with him. He has a great relationship with the press. And, you know, he did that thing, I think you were telling me, where he would go on his Instagram and like post a picture of everybody who interviewed him for the Star Wars The Last Jedi press junket. And stuff like that. But, you know, he, like, somebody asked him about the divisive reaction The Last Jedi got, and he was like, yeah, you know, I mean, people are gonna, you know, I get how important Star Wars is to people, and sometimes, like, their vision of Star Wars is different than what, you know, my vision of Star Wars might be, but, you know, I think most of the people who watched the movie really enjoyed it, and the diehards are going to have their opinions, but I think time's going to be kind to it and all that. He had, like, this really great, like, statement about it, and I'm paraphrasing a lot, but, you know, if I was in his position, I would just be like, fuck you, I made a movie. Yelling at me.
Yeah, and it's so interesting too, because, like, one of the things that I was most excited about when I heard Rian Johnson directing Star Wars was that he would be able to elevate the franchise to another level of filmmaking. I think, right? Yeah. Like, the Star Wars trilogy, the original Star Wars trilogies, are an incredible feat of filmmaking, but at the same time, they're pretty basic. Or it has become that, I guess?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think the Star Wars series has always tried to push new ground. I think the original trilogy has some amazing filmmaking. Like, technologically speaking, like, some of the stuff in there is unreal. I mean, you watch the old making of documentaries about how they made the original Star Wars, and it's like mind blowing, like all this new technology and stuff like that. And even the prequels, like George Lucas, almost made them because he was wanted to try out new tech. You know, that's what,
yeah,
that's what he was doing. And so the prequels, have a lot of problems. And part of the problem is that some of that new tech wasn't as fully formed as it should have been. So, Attack of the Clones was the very first movie ever that was shot digitally. And now, movies are shot digitally. Because Attack of the Clones got there first, you know what I mean?
That's crazy. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, and Attack of the Clones looks like shit. It looks bad.
Yeah, like, it shows that it was the first one.
Yeah, yeah. It looks like a PS2 game in some ways. It's real bad. But the point I'm making is that it's a movie that was trying to push a boundary. It's trying to do something that hadn't been done before, and it didn't necessarily work. But I like that it was taking a risk in that front. And I think when Force Awakens came out, and with Rogue One, these are movies that I feel played it very safe. And Rogue One, to an extent, risked a little bit, but at the same time, it was so beholden to the original movie, it almost couldn't really step out of that shadow.
Yeah.
And I think Force Awakens absolutely is in the same boat. It was so beholden to the original Star Wars, it couldn't really step out of the show. It's essentially a remake of the original Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
And, Force Awakens and Rogue One, I think, are really cool on a visual level. But on a storytelling level, I think they play it incredibly, incredibly safe. And I think with Star Wars The Last Jedi, Rian Johnson has expanded the universe in such a way and tried out so many new things. And I think there's been a huge backlash to that in a certain respect, because he's experimenting, because he's taking risks with this franchise. And I feel like there's a knee jerk reaction from some fans to be like, this isn't Star Wars. I don't like this. Whereas Force Awakens kind of plays it safe and oh no, this is Star Wars. And, I think it's weird because, you had fans on one side who thought Force Awakens played it too safe, and you have fans on another side who thought Last Jedi, it plays it too differently. It doesn't feel as much like a Star Wars movie as it should.
And they're probably the same person.
They're probably all the same reaction. People. And so to me, it's like, I think of all the fan bases, Star Wars fans can be the most intense. And, I almost want, there was an old SNL sketch with William Shatner, where he's like, when he hosted back in the early 90s, late 80s, and it shows him at a Star Trek convention, and people are asking him really inane questions, and he just ultimately sighs and just like, can you people get a life? Like, can you just fucking relax? It was a TV show. And I get that. I kind of get that. Just by reading all the stuff from this past weekend about how people were angry at The Last Jedi, I was like, yeah, just chill. relax, folks.
Yeah, I am interested. I'm sure we're gonna have to get into spoilers to get deep dive into that stuff.
Yeah.
But I can't. My reaction is I can't fathom anything that people would be mad about. I came out of this movie just fucking wrecked, in the best way.
Yeah.
It blew my mind, and I loved it. This movie is incredible. It's Rian. It's the most Rian Johnson-y of the Rian Johnson things.
Yeah.
Well, just about. Fly is probably still the most Rian Johnson of
them. Fly is a pretty Rian Johnson thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but he manages to deftly merge his visual style and his directing techniques with the kind of Disney Star Wars fit our formula or get out thing, which is, like we talked about when they announced that he's getting his own trilogy, is a huge vote of confidence, and I think it paid off that Disney done good.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I was pretty blown away by Star Wars The Last Jedi. I've seen it twice now. Stunned silence, I think, would be a good descriptor for how I came out of this movie the first time. Now, having seen it twice, having read countless reviews and articles, I've been thinking about it pretty much nonstop since my Thursday night showing. I still feel like I'm gathering all my thoughts, but there's so much movie here. I feel like there's so much stuff. Maybe it bites off more than it can chew at certain points. It's just a super ambitious movie, and all I can definitely say is wow. Over the course of two viewings, I loved it when I first saw it, and I feel like my appreciation for it has only grown. And I think, we're doing our top 10 list in 2 weeks for this podcast, and I can't definitively say that Star Wars The Last Jedi will be on that top 10 list, but it's hovering there, man. It is hovering in that. And I've seen a lot of movies this year. I've seen quite a bit. And I did not expect it to be as high as, I did not expect it to be in this, in the upper echelon of movies. I expected, I think Force Awakens made my top 25 of when it came out. It didn't make my top 10, and it didn't make, I don't think, even my top 20, but it was in that 25. And I think Rogue One was in the mid 30s, mid 40s, because I do to keep track of all this stuff because I'm insane.
Uh-huh.
And,
That sounds right.
Yeah. But The Last Jedi, I've just been thinking about this nonstop. Like, this is the Star Wars movie I've been waiting for, I feel like. Like, this is just about everything I could have asked for from a modern Star Wars movie, you know? It yeah. pushes the series into new and exciting territory. It subverts expectation at every turn. It delivers yes. emotional, powerful moments. It experiments with, like, cinematic techniques that we never see on this scale. And it takes risks, you know? It sends its characters and its story down paths that not everybody will be on board with. And it packs so, so much into its lengthy runtime that, you know, some will and have dismissed the film as unfocused. I think that's kind of what, like, some of the complaints have been. But I disagree with that so hard. I think this is a movie that so clearly knows what it's about. And it knows where it wants to go and what it wants to be. And it takes us there. And it is fucking exciting, man. Like, it was electrifying coming out of this yeah. movie both times.
Yeah, I agree. I did see the similar thing to what you were saying where the complaint was, I just kept thinking, why is any of this happening? And my response was, did you miss the first hour, I guess? Because, like, it's pretty yeah. like, it's pretty straightforward why everything is happening. Yeah. I don't understand where that point, you know, that reaction comes from. But that's fine. That person, you know, they're everyone's entitled to their own opinion, even if it's wrong. no. But yeah, I don't know what to say, Mike, because it was that good.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So obviously we're both big fans of Star Wars and we're big fans of Rian Johnson.
Yes.
So I think it's possible that people may listen to this and dismiss our opinions of being biased, of like wanting to like this movie, because, you know, I think we're both pretty in the tank for both of these things. You know, we both like Star Wars, we both like Rian Johnson. But if anything, I think this movie just like enforces why I like Johnson's work so much. And, yeah. You know, why he was such a perfect fit for this series. And it still blows my mind that Lucasfilm and Kathleen Kennedy trusted Rian Johnson, a filmmaker this talented, to just go for broke with the biggest franchise of all time. You know, because I've read interviews with Rian Johnson and he's talked about it. And he was like, yeah, you know, JJ, like I knew where JJ was taking The Force Awakens. I was given the script for that. But they never gave him like an outline. They didn't give him like, you know, anything he was supposed to like beats he was supposed to hit.
Right.
And he was just like, so I was kind of just given freedom to just do whatever I want. I knew this had to be the middle movie. I knew this had to be like kind of the character focused piece. And you know, episode 9 is going to be like kind of the big climax and stuff like that. But this is the movie where, you know, they just let him do whatever. And, he kind of had an idea of where things were going to go later on. He knew what was going on in Force Awakens, but he was given just basically complete freedom to make this. And, you know,
yeah.
By the time this movie was over, I was genuinely upset that we're getting Abrams back for episode 9. Like,
I agree. I was just going to say that I'm kind of sad that we're going to have to go back to J.J. Abrams after this.
Yeah, because I want another Johnson, like, right now. I want that joint happening soon. And, I mean, the fact that he's, you know, doing a whole new trilogy is a nice consolation prize, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I'll take that, I guess. If I have to.
Not going to complain about that. And I think – and Abrams is a good filmmaker. You know, I liked Force Awakens and, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the – what hopefully happens is that Abrams sees what Johnson did with this. Supposedly, Abrams pitched his story for episode 9 this past weekend at Disney, actually. But I'm hoping he kind of picks up the baton that Johnson threw down with this movie and is able to take the series and continue it into more unique, interesting directions. I do think Abrams as a filmmaker is a guy who generally like makes crowd-pleasing, safe movies. You know, I mean, the Star Wars, Force Awakens, and the Star Trek movies and stuff like that. But, you know, I think, you know, maybe with the influence of Johnson, and I think Johnson might still be around because he's making his other trilogy. So maybe he'll be able to have some input in episode 9. I don't know. But, you know, I think the fact that it's Abrams, you know, coming right after Johnson and doing this, like, it's a little bit disappointing for sure. For sure.
Yeah. If he goes back and just does a sort of remake of Return of the Jedi, that'll hurt.
Yeah.
it'll be
a little disappointing. I've seen some people say, like, he might, like, even, like, walk back some of the stuff that Johnson did in this. Like, oh, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into spoilers and stuff like that. But I don't think he will. You know, I think he respects what Johnson did in this movie. And there are certain things that I read about where, like, Johnson was talking about how he and Abrams actually had come independently to the same conclusion as to where certain things in the story had to go. So I trust Abrams with this franchise and what he's doing with it. You know, I like Force Awakens, but again, Johnson really brought something like next level to this series.
Yeah.
You know, something that I've been hoping to feel since these Star Wars movies started. And like, I liked Force Awakens, I liked Rogue One, but this is the movie, man. This is the movie that I think people look back on as, like, the pinnacle of the Disney era of Star Wars. Like, if they never make another movie as good as this, like, it was all worth it to get this movie, The Last Jedi.
To have seen The Last Jedi.
Yeah. I think what helps separate The Last Jedi from Force Awakens or Rogue One is that those movies, I think, feel so beholden to what came before, right? Like we talked about, they don't come out of the shadow of A New Hope. You know, both are so tied to the original Star Wars, neither one really gets out of that shadow. And, you know, we reviewed these movies on this podcast before, so obviously if you need evidence that we like those movies, like,
yeah,
go check those out. And The Last Jedi, like, definitely holds parallels to The Empire Strikes Back and a bit of Return of the Jedi towards the end, too. But it feels decidedly its own thing. And, you know, it references the past on occasion, but it always feels incredibly organic, and it uses the series history to give weight to what's going on right now in the story. Whereas, you know, in other words, there's no, like, Ponda Baba cameo like there was in Rogue One. There's no one hits a table and turns on a chessboard for a second, you know?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
None of that, like, you know, fan service-y, like, hey, remember this? Like, the things. It's all like, stuff that, like, works for character moments in this movie, and I really love that about The Last Jedi.
Yes.
And, you know, part of, another thing I love about this movie, Abrams is a filmmaker, you know, he's a great imitator, right? You know, it's what he's good at. Specifically, he imitates Spielberg. That's his thing. Like, he loves Steven Spielberg movies, like the kind of fantasy sci-fi movies of the 70s and 80s. He's got a directorial voice, but it's as, like, a remix artist, and The Force Awakens is a film that feels like its only influence is the original Star Wars. But what makes Star Wars great in the first place is that, you know, it draws its influences from all the things that made George Lucas tick, right? Like, you know, the original Star Wars is influenced by samurai movies and westerns and World War II documentaries and Flash Gordon serials and anti-Vietnam sentiment and all that shit just thrown into one crazy sci-fi world. And I think that's what Johnson's bringing to the table here, is that The Last Jedi feels as much influenced by, like, Kurosawa and 80s anime as it is The Empire Strikes Back. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree 100%. This movie is doing its fucking best to just be awesome at everything it does. and I'm into every part of it. Johnson is doing, like I had said, I was so excited to see him elevate this franchise, and especially in terms of just, like, cinema. Right. and just like what can be done in a movie. And we'll get into a specific scene in spoilers, I'm sure, but, like, it happens and it goes there and it does a really weird thing, and it's just like, mwah. Yes, just like,
beautiful.
Yes,
beauty.
That, give me that. We're watching that in like you said, the biggest franchise blockbuster, should be the safest four quadrant movie of all time. And JK, we're going to do some experimental film stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there are, like, references to, like, you know, classic films that, like Johnson really loves, just, like, throughout the movie. There's a tracking shot in one scene that recalls the tracking shot from the silent movie Wings. I've actually seen, like, side-by-side comparisons of this.
And it's
really cool. There's a musical cue. I was wondering, you probably didn't catch this, but, you know, John Williams did the score for The Long Goodbye. And there's a musical cue that riffs on the score from The Long Goodbye a little bit in one scene.
Really?
And you just watched it, so I was wondering if you had caught it, but obviously, yeah. I think it's just a really quick thing kind of in the background of a bit, but, you know, and there's a shot, I read about this and I was kind of blown away by it, but there's a shot that is legit a reference to an old short film / infomercial, that parodied Star Wars in the late 70s called Hardware Wars.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I saw Patton Oswalt tweet about this before the movie came out, saying there is a deep cut nerdy Star Wars reference that, you know, no, like, barely anybody will get. And, you know, Patton Oswalt tweeted about it once the movie came out again, and then a couple of critics had tweeted about it too. And I think it was Drew McWeeny or Mike Ryan who had an interview with Johnson. And he mentioned, like, was that supposed to be a Hardware Wars reference? And Johnson just started laughing. It's like, yes, I'm so glad you got that.
Holy crap, that's awesome.
Yeah. But the point is, I think, you know, part of what makes The Last Jedi great is exactly what made the original trilogy great. It is this mishmash of every, like, weird and idiosyncratic thing that the filmmaker loves just thrown out there on the screen. And, you know, it's exhilarating to watch. Before we get into all the spoiler stuff, let's talk about, like, general things. As far as the characters go, I think pretty much everybody is great in this movie.
And
well served. I think Mark Hamill is the obvious standout in this movie. He takes Luke Skywalker in a direction I don't think anyone would expect. And that's been a kind of a touchy subject with some fans in this movie. But, you know, I really think he does an incredible job. And Adam Driver, I think, remains the most interesting actor in these new series as the new characters, as Kylo Ren. I think he's just insane. And every scene Carrie Fisher is in just holds an extra weight to it, knowing this is the last time we're going to see her. Like, I genuinely don't know how episode 9 will handle Carrie Fisher being gone, because it seems like it almost sets it up so that she plays the biggest role in episode 9. And that's, from what I've heard, I think episode 7 was supposed to be the Han movie, episode 8 was supposed to be the Luke movie, and episode 9 was supposed to be the Leia movie. And so that's very much a bummer that we won't be able to see that.
Yeah, there's definitely fighting back tears like every scene she's in. and there's one scene in particular towards the end of the movie in the final act that hits me right here, Mike. Yeah. Just right in my heart.
I feel you. Also want to give a shout out to Donald Gleason, who is somehow playing this role even more over the top than he did in Force Awakens.
God, I love it.
It is incredible. He's fantastic at it. But the movie's plot, I think, are you going to say something, Mike?
I was going to say that he's just playing a cartoon character. Oh, and I can't wait to watch Kylo Ren and General Hux. Is that his name? General Hux, whatever.
General Hux, yeah.
Yeah, just like Abbott and Costello, their way across the galaxy in episode 9. Like, it's the best thing ever. They have the best relationship.
Yeah, I love it so much. And the movie's plot is like deceptively pretty simple, I think, but its themes are really not. This is a movie about failure, and it's about passing down what you learn from that failure. It's a movie about one's place in the universe and how the rebellion or the resistance will not be won by the big names or ancient bloodlines, but by ordinary people clinging to hope, which was also a theme of Rogue One, for sure. It's a movie about the past and about how we as a culture tend to deify the old ways at the expense of newer and potentially better, more progressive ways. It's a movie about powerful women and toxic masculinity, and how even good guys can be oblivious to their own sexism. This movie leaves you with a lot to chew on. And I think the reaction I've seen to it online is honestly heartbreaking. I genuinely had no idea there would be this kind of reaction to it when I watched the movie on Thursday night. I was just so blown away by it. Everybody I was with was like so in love with it, and like we were talking about it for like an hour. And then I went to bed the next day, and that night, woke up the next day, well, I turned on Twitter, and it was just a garbage fire. Like
yeah, it's just rough. But yeah, I love how, you talked about how it definitely has heavy echoes to Empire Strikes Back, just in terms of like its kind of narrative structure in the most general sense.
Yeah,
which is great. I think that's a great take on being influenced by the original, the source or whatever you want to call it, as compared to Force Awakens, which we've talked about is just kind of like a straight up remake, which is fine. But having kind of echoes of the other movie is much more interesting to me. And to have all those themes you just listed are so unique and different to this movie, but also in my mind are inherently Star Wars, right? Yes. What is it not about other than the sins of the father or teacher or authority figure being passed down to the apprentice and strong, powerful women? Leia is like the most powerful woman of all the movies, and just everything you talked about. It's so inherently Star Wars, which makes me so confused when people are like, this movie went in such a weird direction. It's not Star Wars. Mike?
I know, and I think it's fitting that this movie does parallel The Empire Strikes Back in certain ways, because that was a super divisive movie when it came out, and a lot of people don't remember that, because honestly, like, The Empire Strikes Back is a hard sell. It's a much darker movie than the original Star Wars. It divides up its entire cast, and it ends on a major cliffhanger that would not have been answered for 3 years, and it starts in a dark place, ends in a dark place. Like, people were upset about it, and and now we hold it as, like, most people consider it the best Star Wars movie.
It's the best one, yeah.
And in my opinion, one of the best movies of all time. Like, I love The Empire Strikes Back. And I can't say how we'll feel about The Last Jedi like 10 years from now, but I can say that I think time's going to be incredibly kind to this movie. And when people look back on the sequel trilogy, I'm willing to bet I think most of our favorite moments and scenes are going to be from this movie. Like, there's so many things. Like, there are at least 20, like, jaw-dropping moments. legit. I'm saying, like, 20. I'm going with that number. I really feel like there's like my jaw was dropped for like half of this movie.
And 17 of them are porgs.
Very, very true. Anyway, Mike, I think that kind of wraps up our general thoughts on The Last Jedi, because we really got to talk about some spoilery stuff. We haven't even talked about like what the plot actually is yet, because it's Star Wars. I feel like I want to protect that from those who haven't seen it. If you haven't seen it yet, what are you even doing? Go watch Star Wars The Last Jedi. Do not let the really loud, angry people catch you down. This is a great movie. It's not only a great Star Wars movie, it is a great movie, period. Well worth checking out. So I think we can wrap up that segment, and let's move on to spoilers for Star Wars The Last Jedi.
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! You're spoiling it! You're spoiling everything!
All right, so spoilers for Star Wars The Last Jedi, starting right now, so we can really get into the actual movie. So most of the movie takes place over a period of about 24 hours, with the Resistance cornered by the First Order and unable to escape. Like Empire, it divides its characters across several stories. Poe is at odds with Holdo on the ship, Finn, Rose, and BB-8 go on a last-ditch mission to save them, Rey is training with Luke on his isolated island planet of Octo. Now, Mike, what are your overall thoughts on... I mean, we've talked about what our overall thoughts are already. So I guess let's just talk about some of the biggest moments, any moments that stood out to you. For me, the best moment in the entire movie, in a movie filled with incredible moments, is bar none... Laura Dern as Vice Admiral Holdo, her sacrifice play in which she jumps the Resistance ship to light speed and completely slices through the entire First Order fleet.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that is just such an incredible... I mean, the emotion leading into it, like the way it builds up to it with Hux realizing what she's about to do and freaking the fuck out, which is great. And then when it happens and you see like the light speed things coming up, the sound going completely silent, paired with the visual of the ship slicing and turning into like a piece of abstract art. It is fucking marvelous. Like just, I truly breathtaking. One of the best things I've seen in a theater this year. What were you going to say?
It sort of reminded me, abstract art is a really good way to put it. It sort of reminded me of something that like I would have seen in like Sin City, and I don't mean that like Sin City is like avant-garde art kind of thing, but like it effectively goes into black and white and there's no sound and there's just this white streak that appears in every frame.
Yeah.
And it just like it's that kind of visual, I guess it's probably like the black and white, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. That makes me think of that. That makes me think of Sin City. But like that, it's just beautiful. And that moment happens and our theater is just filled with people going, oh shit, like or like one guy's cheering from the back row, like it's such a moment with a capital M, and is just beautiful, and then it just all comes crashing back in as shit explodes, and it's the coolest thing ever.
It is insane. It's maybe like it's maybe the most beautiful image in any Star Wars movie.
Yes.
It's really something else. And I think, you know, one of the things that's so great about it is it's, you know, an incredible image, but it's also, you know, directly rooted in the themes and the characters for this movie. I mean, you know, it's a lesson for Poe and it's a lesson for Admiral Holdo. You know, one complaint I've seen about the film is, you know, well, why doesn't Holdo tell Poe what her plan is, right? That's kind of the that's the one I've been seeing the most. It's like, why doesn't Holdo tell Poe what her plan is? And the reason is because there's a chain of command and Poe had just gotten himself demoted. And proven that he's much more focused on his own heroics than he is the cause of the Resistance. So why should he be trusted? You know, she has no reason to tell him the plan. And, you know, she fails in that front because, you know, maybe she should have told him the plan. But this is a movie in which the heroes essentially fail at every turn. And that's the point, you know. And, you know, after that failure, she then sacrifices herself for the cause, which is a huge moment for Poe when he sees this woman who he didn't respect before, even though he should have. You know, giving up everything just to keep the light burning a little longer, I think is how Leia puts it. And, you know, the important thing to note is that Poe's plan fails too, you know, because when he does find out her plan, he relays that information over an intercom. Benicio del Toro overhears it and he sells out the Resistance to the First Order. Like, you know, that's like the perfect reason why you don't tell Poe your plan is because as soon as he finds out, he fucks it up.
And there's that beautiful refrain, or they say it at least twice, that they're the spark that lights the rebellion, or something along those lines. Spark that lights the something. I can't remember exactly what.
Yeah, spark that begins the fire that lights the rebellion, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just this. It's this absolute last ditch effort to resist everything that's bad that's happening. Right. And yeah, I love Haldo. Laura Dern was fucking hyped. I knew she was in this. I didn't know, you know, I didn't go in unsullied to this. It's pretty impossible to not have seen this movie. I've seen this trailer. So I knew she was in it, but I didn't know what role she was in. So that was awesome to see her.
Yeah.
The Dernissance is in full effect.
Yes, indeed. Twin Peaks, Star Wars, and she was on Big Little Lies this year too. So it's a big year for Laura Dern.
Yeah,
but you didn't know that Benicio del Toro was in this movie, right?
No, yeah, I did not know that Benicio del Toro was in this movie. So that's actually something I want to talk about. Is I've heard the most common complaint that I've seen from people I know on Twitter is that the Canto Bite plotline feels pointless, or not pointless, seems like a waste of time, is how they're saying it. Which what? But also, if you're gonna give me a weird, silly plot in the middle of this dark movie that allows Benicio del Toro to show up, like, do it. Anyone writing a movie and you aren't sure what to do and you want Benicio del Toro, do this thing. But I actually loved Canto Bite. I thought that was such a cool expansion of the Star Wars universe, because that's one of my things that I've always felt with these movies we've talked about before, is the Star Wars universe is a galaxy. It's a literal whole universe.
Yeah.
And we've been following the same six people for eight movies now.
Yeah.
Just about. Yeah. Seven for, movies, I guess,
for some,
technically.
For some reason, Chewbacca's at the center of the universe. Who knew?
Who knew? But we get to go to Canto Bight with is this kind of like casino planet, or at least city. Which right. Everyone knows that in Star Wars, the whole planet is just one city.
Exactly. Yep.
Luke's on an island on a planet. That's a whole planet of islands now.
I think it's a whole planet with just one island. I think is
just one island out there. Probably right. But yeah, it's like a casino city or a casino planet, and Rose tells Finn that it's where all the war profiteers go to spend their exorbitant money, and we kind of have this glimpse into the other layer of the universe of that. There's constant warfare between the Republic or the Empire, First Order, whatever, and the Resistance, and somebody's making lots of dollars off it.
Yeah,
We get a glimpse of that, and then we get Benicio del Toro being silly, and it's the best.
Yes, yeah. I mean, people have dismissed this plotline as pointless and a reason why they don't like the movie. I think at first glance it seems like, okay, well, why are we here? You know, what's the point of this sequence? But like as you watch the movie, I feel like, you know, the thematic implications of what this sequence brings to the table. It makes like the entire, like the last shot of the movie, which is so powerful and so poignant, would lose that power because, you know, that happens like the Canto Bight sequence is what gives that stuff weight. You know, you get a sense of like how this war is affecting other people in the galaxy. You see who is profiting off of it, who is suffering because of it. But they don't really, like, the people of that planet, like they couldn't give a shit about what the rebels and the Empire are up to, or whatever, or the First Order and the Resistance are up to, because you know they're just trying to live their life, which I think is how a majority of people feel most of the time. Like, they don't care what the governments are up to as long as, you know, you can live like comfortably or whatever. And I think that, you know, that it's sort of making the point of like, well, like, you become comfortable because this is what you know, without kind of acknowledging kind of the horrors that this organization is bringing you, and you need, it's time for you to step up, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult reality for a lot of people to face. And I think that's part of Finn's arc throughout this movie. And I think part of the reason Canto Bight works is because it directly informs Finn's entire arc. You know, one of the things my brother, I was arguing with him about this movie because he didn't like it. And he was saying that, you know, how, like, Finn's just, you know, some like I didn't buy Finn's like character or whatever. You know, he went to fight the First Order in the last movie. And, you know, now he's deserting and, like, you know, he sacrificed himself. Like, that's supposed to be a big transition, but he did in the last movie. And I was like, no, you don't remember correctly, because the only reason Finn helps the Resistance in the last movie is because the First Order has Rey, and then he wants to find Rey, and that's the only thing he thinks about, is because he made a connection with Rey and he wants to save her. Like, the Resistance is completely ancillary to Finn. It's just a means to an end. He actually puts most of the Resistance in danger towards the end of that movie by putting a plan in motion that he was not prepared to execute. And at the beginning of this movie, his first question when he wakes up is, where's Rey? Right.
Right.
And so his whole mindset is just, I need to keep Rey safe, kind of thing. But because of Canto Bight and because of the result of things that happen from there, and the betrayal of Benicio del Toro's character, Finn kind of starts to begin to understand the cause of the resistance, and begins to kind of embrace that. And so you have that fight with Phasma between her and Finn, and there's that big moment where she says, "You've always been scum," and he kind of has this triumphant, like, "Rebel scum," and it's like, yes, fuck yes, Finn is in. Finn is in. Like, that's such a huge, like, transformative character moment for Finn. And then towards the end of the movie, Finn is ready to sacrifice himself for, you know, the cause of the resistance, and then tries to, and then Rose, you know, knocks him out, takes him down. And I think the Canto Bight is such a huge moment for Rose too. I mean, Rose is a new character for this movie. And I've seen some people reject that notion that, like, we want to spend time with the characters we already know. We don't want to, like, have to learn new people. And it's like, yeah, cause you know, Lando, like, it's not like new characters are a new thing in the Star Wars universe. Like,
ridiculous,
you know. But Rose's whole thing is that, you know, when you first see her, she, like, sees Finn and she's, like, almost awestruck, like, wow, you fought against Starkiller Base, you're, like, this, like, resistance hero. And he's like, yeah, you know, whatever. And, you know, I think she, like, you see her and she starts off in a very heartbreaking place. Her sister has just died, Paige, who, by the way, that opening sequence is just incredible. It's amazing how attached I got to this character who I've never seen before in my life. And, you know, how affected I was by her death when she sacrifices herself to destroy the dreadnought. But so you see Rose in this very, you know, upsetting place, and she's, like, deifying Finn a little bit. But then, you know, her arc throughout the movie is, like, realizing, like, you know, you don't have to look up to your heroes. You can just be one. And that's kind of the whole theme of the movie. It's what you get at that final shot, is, like, the kid, like, looking up into the sky, like Luke looked up in the twin suns, you know, just dreaming of something more and dreaming of, like, you know, a better future. You know, you can be part of that. And that's kind of what Rose is. And that's when, so I think Rose taking out Finn's sacrifice is as much of a huge character transformation moment as that sacrifice for Finn himself. And she has that line at the end of the movie, "We're going to win this, not by destroying what we hate, but by saving what we love." And I think that was a very powerful moment for the movie to go for. And so all this is a way of saying the Canto Bight stuff is hugely important. All of that comes from Canto Bight, and it blows my mind that people think that stuff is pointless. Like, you can say you don't like that stuff as much as the other stuff in the movie, and that's fine, but to say it's completely pointless, I think completely misses the point in a lot of respect. Hey.
I mean, that, I agree. And I think that's, I we also benefit from getting cute giant dogs out of it.
Also true.
But yeah, no, I, everything you just, that whole thing you just said, yes. Or ditto.
But anyway, and I just loved, like, I loved the whole atmosphere of Canto Bight, because it did feel like something new that we hadn't seen before. It almost felt like, you know, when Force Awakens, like, they had their obligatory cantina scene with Maz Kanata's thing, and it just felt like, oh, we're doing the cantina now. But with Canto Bight, it's a very similar kind of setup, but it doesn't feel like, you know, oh, we're doing the cantina now. It feels like, oh, we're seeing this, like, kind of new and fresh place that we've never really seen before in a Star Wars movie, like this upscale kind of casino area with all these different new and different, like, weird creatures, you know, and there's a lot of fun sight gags. Like, there's a lot of, like, really good stuff in that Canto Bight sequence. So yeah, anyway, let's get off Canto Bight, because I feel like we've been talking about it for 10 minutes. but I did want to talk about how almost hilarious it is how much this movie completely undoes so much of what Force Awakens sets up, or what people perceived as Force Awakens setting up, but really it was just the movie. You know, being a thing, and fans, like, kind of extrapolating stuff from it. And it shows that this is, it's completely its own thing. The very first time you see Luke, you know, it's continuing that moment from the end of Force Awakens where Rey is handing him his lightsaber. It's this big, beautiful moment at the end of Force Awakens. And the very first time it follows up on that, you see Rey holding up the lightsaber to Luke, and he holds it for a second and then tosses it behind him and leaves. Like, And that's, like, the mission statement of this movie. You know, that's basically like the moment that kind of defines the movie for me. Because so much of this movie is like, oh, who was Snoke? Doesn't matter. He's dead. Who were Rey's parents? Nobody. Shut up. What about the Knights of Ren? Not in this movie. Fuck you. Like, like, there's so much stuff that Force Awakens does that people have been, you know, theorizing about for 2 years. And I think that's partially because, you know, I don't think Force Awakens gives you that much to go on with all those things. It just kind of introduces them with the, and I think fans expected, well, this will be explained later on. And, you know, I think in some cases they might still be, but you know, I think part of it is because J.J. Abrams has this reputation of having the mystery box and introducing mysteries and never solving them. You know, that was the whole thing with Lost and stuff like that. And so I think fans have been analyzing Star Wars The Force Awakens because of J.J. Abrams' reputation and finding mysteries that maybe were never really there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I'll be honest, this, like people have been thinking about Snoke for years. There are, you can go online and find like 30-minute YouTube essays about who Snoke could possibly be. And just think about all the fucking wasted time that
was. Yeah. Which is the best.
It's so funny. I mean, because to me, Snoke was never that interesting. He was just, you know, Emperor 2.
Yeah.
And now he's dead. Snoke is dead now, Mike. Snoke is dead. He is deader than dead. Dead as a doornail. It's my
he's an ex Snoke.
You are an ex person. Yeah. yeah, ex Snoke. And Snoke's death comes as a genuinely shocking moment. You know, I think this movie was utilizing Snoke much more effectively than Force Awakens did up to that point. But it is a terrific subversion of expectations and just an amazing character moment for Kylo Ren. I mean, this character, who was essentially just the Emperor II, has now paved the way for the rise of Kylo Ren, who is a really unstable character dictated by his emotions that has now done what his idol Darth Vader could not do, did not do, and actually usurps the power of the dark side. Like, he is in charge of everything now. And, you know, it's so nuts. And people complain that, like, you know, we're never going to learn anything about Snoke now. And, like, isn't it better just have that unexplained, I feel like? Isn't it better just have that in the margins? I'm sure there will be some kind of ancillary novel that explains all of Snoke's shit if you really need to know. But, like, you know, we if you think about it, like, when the original trilogy came out, we didn't know anything about the Emperor, right? The original trilogy gives you nothing about who the Emperor is. You just know he's Darth Vader's master, and that's enough. That is enough for those movies.
Yeah.
And then the prequels came out and it explained all the Emperor stuff and it kind of makes it less interesting, right?
Yeah, I think I remember watching Matt Colville. I've talked about his YouTube channel before on here. He was happened to be talking about Star Wars and just how George Lucas understood that you can say things to the audience and not have to necessarily explain it.
Right.
Like, we get the Kessel Run gets name dropped and it's never brought up again, and it's awesome. Who cares? It doesn't matter what it is. It's a cool thing that Han said.
Exactly. You say something like, "Oh, I'm glad you fought with my father in the Clone Wars" or something, and it's like, yeah, what were the Clone Wars? People just wonder what the Clone Wars were for 20 years, and then we got them, and it was a little disappointing.
Yeah, but exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, like, just prepare yourselves for when we see the Kessel Run in the Han Solo movie. Oh, it's dumb.
It's definitely happening, yeah.
It's going to be dumb. Also, I did love the Parsecs shout-out in Last Jedi.
I love that they're committing to the Parsecs thing, which, yeah.
Yeah.
People have joked about Parsecs for a long time that it's, you know, that the line makes no sense because Parsecs is a unit of distance, not distance. Time, right?
Yeah.
But he says it as if it's a unit of time. Like, oh, we made it in less than 10 Parsecs. And, you know, I think there's a line in Force Awakens where they reference that too, where they say, like, oh, this is the ship that made the Kessel Run less than 12 parsecs or something like that. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's a like kind of dumb little callback that they do all the time in Force Awakens. But in this, it's just kind of like a casual, like, throwing in conversation, like, oh, we're like 4 parsecs away or something. And it's like, I guess we're committing to that now.
Matt Colville talks about how the Emperor is much more interesting as a 30-foot hologram that Lord Vader kneels to. We don't need to know about his rise to power and all that stuff. And I think Rian Johnson probably agrees with that sentiment that having Snoke, especially in Force Awakens, was actually a 30-foot hologram.
Yeah.
And then we get to see him in this one in person, and then that's it. His mystery, narrative purpose has been served. The impetus to launch Kylo Ren into his rage and put him on his path is finished. We don't need him anymore. See you later. And that battle scene, that fight scene was fucking rad.
It's so
so cool.
Just insane. One of the best lightsaber fights of any Star Wars movie. Truly, really great.
Yeah.
But I mean, going back to Snoke a little bit, I mean, you know, part of what drove the original Star Wars trilogy is that anti-Vietnam sentiment that I was talking about before. Do you know what movie Lucas was working on at the same time as he was making the original Star Wars?
I do not know.
It's Apocalypse Now.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, he was actually – George Lucas was going to make Apocalypse Now, and then he got so bogged down in Star Wars stuff that he passed down to Francis Ford Coppola. But he was going to make it. So there's a lot of that sentiment in the original Star Wars that I feel like people don't think about enough. And you know, so the Star Wars is so much an analog for, you know, fascism and like how he perceived, mm-hmm. you know, like it's about like a small group of freedom fighters fighting off against this oppressive force that's trying to invade them. And like, yeah, that's Star Wars. But, you know, and I think this movie kind of takes that same concept. Obviously, this movie started filming like early 2015, like late 2015. So it's like, it's not like it had all this in mind, but Snoke could be read as an analog for Trump. You know, he could just be, he could just be some guy who was powerful enough and rich enough to rally the worst people in the galaxy around him so that he could rise to power. Or not, because who cares? This is not his story. You know, this is the story of Kylo Ren rising to power. He is the most dynamic character in this entire new trilogy, I think.
I was going to say, we talked about it when we got out of the theater, that Kylo is a much more interesting character and villain, because he has put himself in a position that he's unprepared for, and he probably knows it, and he knows, he's aware of the fact that he's unfit to be the Supreme Leader. And he's now going to have to grapple with that and decide what he does with that power, and that's a much more interesting character arc or path, or something I'm much more interested to watch than the guy who's already in power manipulating somebody else.
Yeah, because we've seen that before. That's already a thing. Yeah. That was the thing in the prequels. That was the thing in the originals. Like, we've seen that. We've got that already. We don't need that anymore. This is the brand new thing. And that's part of the thesis of this movie, is like, we love the original stuff. We are beholden to it, but we do not have, like, we don't need to do that anymore. You know, part of, I mean, Kylo even says, like, you know, let the past die, kill it if you have to. Like, and that's kind of what this is. This movie has to break Star Wars because it loves Star Wars so much. You know what I mean?
It has to Old Yeller Star Wars.
Exactly. And I think part of that is, you know, the reveal of Rey's parents plays a huge role in that sense. You know, one of the big things surrounding The Force Awakens is like, oh, who were Rey's parents? Because they have to be, you know, somebody huge. She has to be either a Skywalker or a Solo or like Snoke's daughter twice removed. Or like,
is it a Kenobi?
Is she a Kenobi? Is she the adopted daughter of Watto and Kit Fisto or something? Like, just some weird...
It's Nine Nub. It's Nine Nub.
It's Nine Nub. We all knew it was Nine Nub. And this movie finally answers the question, and it's the best version of that answer it could have been. And it's what I've been saying for years, that this should be the case. Rey's parents are nobody. Like, they're just random people, like, that were kind of assholes who, like, sold her off for beer money, I think is what they say, or drinking money is how Kylo calls it. And that is the best thing they could have done with that answer, because every known character who could have been Rey's parent would be a disappointing answer, I think. Or it would make no sense. I was holding out hope for Watto, but that would make no sense. But I think having Rey just be a person emphasizes the film's larger point, which is that for the galaxy to survive, and for the Force ways to survive, for the Jedi and the Sith's ideals to survive, you know, we need to do away with the notions of lineage and of tradition and bloodline, and embrace the idea that the rebellion will be won by average people. And you know, that's, I mean, I just went on a rant about that, about the Cantabite stuff for like 10 minutes. But that is what
let's loop back around to it. One more time.
Let's loop back around. Cause that is what the Cantabite stuff serves to establish. But it ties back to that final moment in the movie, right? That final shot, where we see this young force sensitive kid holding a broom like a lightsaber, wearing Rose's resistance ring and looking into the sky. Like I said before, like Luke looks out onto the twin suns on Tatooine. And it is it has so much power because of what this movie does with Cantabite, but also I'm not letting this go. But also with that answer to Rey's parentage, like, you know, and now, you know, obviously Carrie Fisher won't be in Episode 9, which means we are looking at our first Skywalkerless Star Wars movie. And that's you know, partially terrifying, but also partially exciting. This is new territory. That, you know, Star Wars hasn't done new territory in a long, long time. Like, you know, even Force Awakens and Rogue One played it really safe. The prequels expanded the universe in really interesting ways. But, you know, it was telling a story that we already knew. It was just telling a story building up to the story that we already knew. So this, like, really, the Star Wars movies haven't had any new territory done since 1983. And like, that's insane to me that it's been that long. But this feels like the first movie that could be, like, of a piece with those ones in terms of how it expands the universe and how it is as thematically rich as those movies.
Yes, I agree. Go ahead.
I was going to say, as a side note, somebody did tell me that the kid who's at the end of this movie was the kid from Looper and Sonny Jim on Twin Peaks, but I don't think it is. If it is, though, cool. Like, that's...
Yeah, good for that guy.
Yeah.
I agree that having Rey's parents just be some junkers or whatever they are is the best. That's the coolest fucking thing. I was so excited at the prospect of when the new Star Wars movies were announced, of it being all new shit, like having it not be the Skywalker legacy anymore.
And
I'm still down with that, but I am so excited to finally move beyond the, like we said, the same six people that are at the center of this entire universe and get some new stuff happening.
Yeah.
That was, you know, part of the prospect of why I was so pumped for Rogue One, even though it was, you know, part of the same story and we've kind of seen that stuff before. It wasn't about the Skywalkers. And right. It wasn't about
mostly new characters in that movie.
Yes. Yeah. Which is awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm so pumped for episode 9, where it's going to be, you know, no Skywalkers.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess one Solo, technically.
Yeah. Like he is really kind of the only Solo slash Skywalker left standing. I mean, we got to talk about Luke Skywalker in this movie.
Well, I guess we kind of, we already started talking about that.
This is our transitional period. Speaking of the Skywalkers, got to talk about Luke, who is just broken in this movie.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's insane. So he is revealed to accidentally having created Kylo Ren. In a sequence that directly recalls Kurosawa's Rashomon, which is pretty cool, and has shut himself off from the Force and from the outside world. He's living in exile like Yoda did on Dagobah, and just everything between him and Rey is fantastic. Just so good. And it helps. I think this movie really blurs the line between the dark side and the light side of the Force in a way that the other films have never really done. Like, it feels like... I feel like I get why somebody would turn to the dark side of the Force in this movie, you know? That always just seemed like an abstract, like, well, there's a good side and a bad side, so don't be on the bad side. And then be like, all right, but, like, some people are drawn to the bad side, and it's like, why? Because they're bad. And
Because they have red lightsabers.
Because they have red lightsabers, yeah. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, I feel like the morals of Star Wars have always been pretty cut and dry. But I think this movie, and Rogue One as well a little bit, work to... kind of blur those lines and like show you the moral ambiguity behind all that. And you know, Rogue One did that in terms of like what the rebellion does to like as a means to an end kind of thing for their battles. But I think it's much more effective here, as this kind of like the moral ambiguity of this metaphysical force, that, you know, binds the entire world together. And that like the dark side has to exist, for the light side to exist kind of thing. It's a very much yin and yang sort of thing. And so I really love the way this movie illustrated that, and I think his conversation with Yoda, Luke's conversation with Yoda, who also appears in this movie, by the way, Yoda's in here, and it's amazing, very much illustrates the themes of the film loud and clear. You know, I think Yoda says, we are what they grow beyond, you know, we are here and we do our thing, and then they do their thing, and like the younger generation rises and hopefully does better than we did. You know, whatever it is we did, we may have done good things. But we probably also did bad things. We may have fucked up a lot of times, and the younger generation will hopefully fix those mistakes and move forward. And that's kind of been everything since the dawn of time, right? That's kind of like, hopefully the next generation will be pretty great. I saw somebody tweet, a pretty funny reaction to, the movie. I think it was Siddhanta Adanka from, Birth, Movies, Death, who said that, you know, I really enjoyed The Last Jedi, but it was a little weird that, Kylo Ren just turned to the camera and said, "You baby boomers are ruining everything, and us millennials have to clean it up for you." And then somebody responded to it, and he's like, "Yeah, but also,
but like mostly."
But yeah, and then I mean, you got to talk about Luke's like big moment, defending the Resistance base on the salt mining planet of Crait is the name of that planet, and his fight with Kylo, and then the reveal that he's not actually there, that it's an astral projection that he's like forcing there. They're still back at the island. That is so well telegraphed that you don't even realize it. And like, when I first watched the movie, I was watching it and I really thought Luke was there. And then he pulled out his lightsaber and I was like, wait, that lightsaber was destroyed, earlier in the movie. Yeah. We had just seen that happen. So I was like, did he have another lightsaber? Like, I was a little confused. And then, you know, it was revealed that he was an astral projection. I was like, okay, that makes sense. But there are more hints, than just that. Because Luke looks a little bit younger, in that sequence.
Yeah.
He kind of looks like he does in the flashbacks of the movie, where you see, Luke and Kylo. So I think that's sort of meant as like a way to like kind of mess with Kylo. Like, he's appearing exactly as Kylo remembers him. But most awesomely, he does not leave red footprints in the salt when he walks.
Oh shit. That's awesome.
Right?
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, I didn't until the second time I saw it, and I was like, oh my God, that is so fucking cool. Like, that's because they make a point, you know, they make a point to show you that, you know, it's a salt planet, and every time you move the ground, like, I guess there's a red, kind of finish underneath it. Or something like that. I don't know how.
Sure. The salt crystals are red or whatever. Yeah.
But it, you move it and it has this red, which, by the way, the red looks amazing. Like, this movie uses red very effectively as a color. But, you know, every time, like, you move around on the ground, like, you see the ship speeding by and red dust flies backwards and stuff like that. Anytime somebody walks around, you see red, like, footprints and stuff like that. And nothing of that with Luke. And it's such a small touch and it's so effective. And, you know, and then Luke just finally at peace, telling Kylo, "See you around, kid," before disappearing, you know, and then finally, like, actually you see him back at the island and disappearing for real, just, you know, staring at a twin sunset, just like the beginning of the original movie. And it's goddamn beautiful and it's poetic. And I want Mark Hamill to win an Oscar as,
he does an incredible job. And yeah, I thought that scene originally, well, the scene that hit me right in the heart and made me definitely cry was when Mark Hamill sits and talks with Leia, or Luke sits and talks with Leia in the base. Just knowing like that, how much they meant to each other and just what they're talking about, you know, the legacy they're leaving behind and that, and that, Carrie Fisher is not here anymore. Yeah. It just was like, oh no.
So I from Han's ship as well, the Millennium Falcon.
From the Falcon. Yeah. And I thought that was, them connecting to, like, force talking, whatever, that, like, that the way Rey and Kylo do earlier in the movie. So I didn't think he was there. I thought he was just, like, they were communicating to each other and having this moment amidst this battle.
Yeah.
And then he gets up and talks to C-3PO, and I was like, oh shit, he's actually there. That's crazy. How did he get there? That's weird.
Yep.
So that's awesome that he doesn't leave footprints in the salt. That's incredible. And that battle is so cool. And just awesome.
Just visually, just really insane. It looks like I think somebody pointed it back to a late period Kurosawa movie, and I think it was Ren or Kagamusha. And like, it just looks real, real cool. But yeah, I mean, just the way it uses red to like illustrate that scene, because I think some people have dismissed it as just it's going back to Hoth again. But like, it's really, functionally, yes, it kind of is. Although Hoth is at the beginning of Empire Strikes Back, and this is the big climax of the movie. But you know, I think functionally, yes, it still kind of is that. But it seems much like a much more unique take on that planet than say Jakku did with Tatooine, right? In A New Hope or Force Awakens, I mean. Like Jakku was just Tatooine. Like there's nothing new about Jakku that Tatooine didn't have. And this at least has that red that differentiates visually this planet from Hoth. I like that about it.
And as you pointed out, the big climax is just a samurai duel.
Yes.
Like it's this whole battle with the AT-ATs and all this crazy shit. Well, it's not even a real battle, but there's like this whole thing about to happen. And then Kylo's just like, no, send me down there. And they just fucking duel.
Yeah.
Which is so cool.
It's so good. And I think part of what I love about this over The Force Awakens, and again, I like The Force Awakens, I don't mean to keep shitting on it, but this movie classes it in every way. And and you know, I think Force Awakens, its stakes are so big, right? There's you have Starkiller Base, the Death Star, that is not only the size of a moon, it is the size of a fucking planet, and it blows up five different planets in the span of 2 minutes. And so you like the stakes are so big that they feel almost inconsequential, right? Like that's like they're too big at that point. Whereas Last Jedi, its stakes are comparatively much smaller. It's only affecting the Resistance themselves and not really any of the outside world or the outside galaxy. But because of because you spent so much time with these characters and because you spent so much time getting to know these characters on, you know, sequences like Canto Bight and. I think it holds a lot more weight because of it. You know, I feel like, you know, watching that final showdown between Kylo Ren and Luke is incredible. And Luke's not even doing anything. He's not even like attacking him because he's not there. You know,
right.
He's just dodging moves. And like, there's not even really like an actual fight. And that's like, it's kind of ballsy on that front. And there's like a, you know, there's a battle before that on the actual planet. And it's really cool. You have that line of old Resistance ships with like just with the red dust flowing back, and you have the Finn sacrifice play, Rose saving her. You have the Millennium Falcon swooping in with Rey shooting and Chewbacca driving, and it's awesome. It also results in one of my favorite line readings in the entire movie, where Adam Driver like sees it, freaks out, and like grabs a guy on the shoulder and goes, "Blow that ship right out of the sky!" just a completely over the top read. I love that. And you know, I like it's just so much. And you know, I don't want to focus just on the banter of this movie, Because the banter ultimately is like the last thing, like it's like a cherry on top almost. Like it's like on top of being this thematically rich and really interesting movie, it's also really funny. And I've seen a lot of people argue that it's too funny. Like the humor verges on like Spaceballs, and I think that's insane. But
what?
You know, I think at its heart, you know, I feel like these people who are complaining about it being really funny have forgotten that Star Wars has always been a pretty funny franchise.
And, yeah,
you know, at its heart, this is still a big, insane, fun space movie, and all of the humor feels of a piece with the original trilogy. And one of my favorite bits is that banter during the action sequence when the Millennium Falcon shows up again, and Kylo orders everybody to shoot him down, and like the Millennium Falcon starts dodging shit, and I think it's Finn and Poe who say something like, "It's like, oh man, look at that," and Finn's like, "Oh yeah, they hate that ship." Like kind of laughing about it. Like it's great. It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to move on or wrap up without talking about the infinite ray, Ray scene.
Holy shit.
That's the moment where it's like, oh yeah, Rian Johnson is fucking here and he's going to do his thing and he doesn't care if you're along for the ride or not.
Yes. Yeah. That is some awesome Rian Johnson weirdness. With
Rey. Yeah.
It's Rey's like force vision. That seems like it will reveal her parents. It's kind of playing with that expectation.
Right.
And it's, you know, just like a million rays standing in a line, almost synchronized, but not, you know, and it kind of creates an echo effect. So like she moves her hand and you see like all the rays kind of move their hand in succession, but it's not at the same time. It's just like 1 second delay kind of thing. And it's really cool. And I think the best effect is when she snaps her fingers and you hear that kind of like echoey snap sound, like snap, snap, snap.
Yeah. And then the camera travels up and down the line. It's beautiful. And I love that this is, as you were talking about earlier, kind of a actual concrete visual representation of the dark side, right? Or the lure of the dark side. Because when Rey, you know, when I just remembered the joke they do where Luke is like, okay, trying to show Rey to reach out and feel the force. And he like tickles her with the thing, with the palm frond or whatever. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
But she says like, oh, there's something beneath the island and it's. Offering me something or whatever it is, and she kind of goes for it, and Luke has the reaction of this dark side offered you something you needed and you didn't even try to resist it.
Yes,
which is awesome. That you know, as a character moment, that's really cool to see Rey and to see Luke be afraid of that. You know, we later find out it's because he allowed Kylo to have that reaction or whatever. But well, as you said, we never really know anything about the dark side other than that it is the dark side, and it allowed Darth Plagueis to come back from the dead or whatever the hell happened in the prequels, whatever that copypasta meme is. So to see Rey kind of like actively seek that out and go experiment with it and see what it is and ultimately find out that it's not worth her time, right? At the end of the million, the infinite rays, she gets the answer of or she thinks she's about to get the answer of who her parents are, and it turns out it's just her reflection, and she's like, "This is dumb," which is all. That's a cool way to show her rejection of the dark side.
Absolutely. And I think part of the one of the most interesting relationships this movie sets up is the one between Rey and Kylo Ren, who have this kind of force connection that Snoke has set up. So they're seeing each other like randomly and talking to each other, and they kind of both start to form like sort of understanding of each other in certain ways. Like Rey sees how Kylo can be brought back to the light. Kylo sees how Rey can be brought to the dark side, and they both try to kind of convince the other one that their way is the correct one. And so you have that kind of antagonistic attitude that, but also like they want to be in each other's lives, sort of like they're both like pulled to each other in a certain way.
Yeah.
But they're both so like fundamentally different on the inside that it's never going to work. That moment, you know, that huge lightsaber battle where the two of them are just fighting off all those red guards. Incredible. Like, so good. We talked about that before. It's so great. And then it ends and, you know, they have, like, Kylo tries to get her to join him. And she, like, realizes what's happening. Like, he's just killed Snoke. He's about to rule the First Order and kind of, it's basically just gonna be another dictatorship. She realizes that and tries to pull him away from that, and it's not happening. And they kind of have this, they start fighting each other, and at one point, Rey tries to grab Luke's lightsaber with the force, and Kylo also grabs it, and then it is destroyed. It breaks in half, and that is about as major an indication as any that this franchise is ready to move on from the past, and it's set forth on this bold new path, you know. And that's that's just so exciting to me. And I wanted to go back to that sequence actually, because that is so much fun. I mean, it's like cutting through like three or four different climaxes all at once.
I was just going to say that. Yeah.
And then, you know, all that stuff happens and then there's still like a half hour movie left. Like,
yeah, if I remember correctly, the lightsaber shatters in a burst of light. And then we smash cut to Holdo jumping into hyperspace, I think. Right? Yeah, so those scenes
at the same time, and it's amazing.
Those scenes paired together, those two climaxes back to back make quite an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the you know, obvious influence and echo in the scene with Rey and Kylo Ren is Vader and Luke in Empire Strikes Back, because it's the same speech he gives, basically. Just it's not your father. It's the come and stand beside me and we can rule the galaxy together. It's just as instead of as father and son, it's whatever they are.
Yeah, it even has a parental reveal. It's just not the I'm your father thing. It's your parent,
right.
Nobody.
Which fucking, mwah, like everything else in this movie.
Yeah, that's the thing. And that's like, you know, I've seen people like complain like, oh, it's just Empire Strikes Back again. But it's not really. It's paralleling Empire Strikes Back in really interesting ways. I think kind of like the prequels do with the original trilogy. But, you know, Force Awakens really just feels like a remake of A New Hope. And this feels like it's taken some cues from Empire Strikes Back. It's doing some of the same stuff. But it's doing it in a new and refreshing way. And, you know, it makes it feel like it's something I haven't seen before. And that's, I think, the most important part here. Otherwise, random bits. I mean, also during that climax scene, there's the amazing moment where an AT-ST just starts firing and BB-8 is the one who's piloting it, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, which is like I love that. That's sort of a like kind of throwback to the droid shenanigans that C-3PO and R2-D2 get into in the prequels. Like they're just involved in everything for some reason.
Exactly.
which is so much fun. And that we talked about that. You mentioned the Phasma Finn battle, which fucking rad as hell. Yeah,
very cool. I'm a little like a little bummed that Phasma wasn't a bigger character in these two movies. You know, I feel like that's definitely a spot where that could have been improved upon, because Phasma just seemed like, you know, it was a cool, like, she's very much the Boba Fett of this new series, I guess.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that Boba Fett actually accomplishes something. by delivering Han Solo to Jabba, whereas you know, Phasma has done like nothing, and like, mm-hmm. But at least that fight was really cool between her and Finn. It was a lot of fun to watch, and I honestly I wouldn't put it past JJ to bring her back for Episode 9 somehow.
I mean, we do see her die.
We see her fall off. We see her fall into a fiery abyss, which is presumably going into space. But like, you never know.
I don't know, last time we saw her in Force Awakens, well, we don't actually see her get put into the trash compactor, but they ask about it. I definitely am disappointed with how they've used Phasma, because that's such a waste of Gwendolyn Christie.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
It's like, it's incredible.
Yeah. I figured she would take off her helmet at some point, at least, and she doesn't. I mean,
we get an eye.
You see her eye, because the helmet breaks a little bit, but yeah.
Is there anything else, though, Mike? I'm interested if there's any other stuff that do you want to gush about for 45 minutes?
I'm sure there is. I want to talk about that Justin Theroux cameo.
back to Cantobite. What a surprise.
Back to Cantobite. Maybe the reason I love Cantobite so much is I got a quick glimpse of Justin Theroux, which was pretty great. And I'm counting it as an extended scene of The Leftovers in which Kevin Garvey is having one of his afterlife trips. I think that's what's going on.
Actually, you know what? I love it even more now that I'm realizing that it fits the theme of the Resistance and the average Joe being the guy that will save everything, because they go for the master code breaker and fail at it and get this pickpocket guy.
Right, but they also end up not being able to trust him because he betrays him. And I think that's actually kind of the key to the movie. I think people have had a kind of a mixed reaction to Benicio del Toro's character. You know, he's a device. Like, I could see why. Like, he has that stutter. Yeah. There's a weird affectation with that guy. He's doing a weird performance, and I dig it, but not everybody will, and that's fine. But I think people have been like, well, what was the point of that character or whatever? Because again, like, Finn and Rose's journey ultimately has no impact on what's actually going on in the movie, but it's really important for those characters, you know, and it's important for the thematic element of the movie to make this movie about failure. Because, you know, like, yeah, their journey has no impact. They're just basically, all that happens is they get betrayed and most of their team gets blown up. I think DJ is the character's name, Benicio del Toro. And I think, I think having him there is such a important thing for Finn. You know, Finn kind of sees what he could be if he lets himself be, like this kind of like amoralistic dude who is always like never gets involved with the fight and is always just like looking out for himself, and he realizes he doesn't want to be that, and that's what kind of makes him be makes him embrace the resistance cause.
He has that moment when they're on the ship together after they escape Cantabite, and Benicio del Toro is going through like the plans of whoever previously owned the ship, and he's like, oh, he sold weapons to the bad guys, and it gets to an X-wing, and he's like, oh, and the good guys.
Yeah.
And Finn has that kind of crisis of conscience moment where he realizes, you know, there's more to this whole thing that he's realizes or is ever has been thinking about for the last movie and a half.
It makes it makes the point of the movie Lord of War with Nicolas Cage so much more effectively than Lord of War does in that 30-second
yeah. Like we said in our Complete Works episode, if the movie ended after the opening credits, Lord of War would have made sense. Yeah. It would have been good.
But anyway, yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up, Mike, Star Wars The Last Jedi wise? I mean, we could talk about this for another 2 hours.
But... We really could. Porgs are cool, I guess. Snow dog.
Porgs, yeah.
Snow dogs, pretty dope. Like them a lot. Yeah.
The crystal foxes.
Crystal foxes. About, yeah. I like the big racy dogs with the floppy ears. They were fun.
They were fun too. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we haven't talked about porgs at all, but porgs are delightful. They're a delightful addition to this movie. They don't affect the plot at all. Like they're just kind of a foil for Chewbacca, which is entertaining. But you know, they're an enjoyable addition to the Star Wars universe. And I look forward to seeing more of them in the years to come.
I can't wait for all the merchandising.
Yes, the Porg spinoff series and the movies are going to be great. The Porgs of Madagascar.
I would watch the shit out of an animated Porgs TV show. Just saying.
But anyway, yeah, I think that about wraps up for today, Mike. I truly think Star Wars The Last Jedi, one of the best Star Wars films, easily the best of the Disney era, and I think one of the best franchise films of this year. And this year has had some incredible franchise movies. I mean, War for the Planet of the Apes, Logan, Blade Runner 2049. I have seen this movie twice and will likely see it at least a third time, if not a fourth. This feels like not only a great Star Wars film, but also the one that we kind of need right now. in a lot of ways. Any last thoughts, Mike, or should we wrap this up?
No. I think you very eloquently said most of my thoughts. Okay. So cool, we can wrap beans. It up.
All right, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Plus, I've got some work at crookedmarquee.com. You can check that out there. Thank you so much for listening to Filmbook Cast. I am Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this podcast via our iTunes stuff, please subscribe to it, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to our podcast at filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you email about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones. Hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us for the next episode of Film Book Cast, where we'll be doing our year in review and discussing our top 10 films of 2017. And you can check out our next Complete Works for next week, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2007's National Treasure, Book of Secrets. That's a pretty exciting one, Mike. I'm looking forward to taking that one on. So thank you.
I agree.
Yes.
So, man, sorry. I tried to get it in. I tried.
You tried. You were yawning while I was talking, and then as I continued, I paused, and then you were still yawning, and I was like, never mind. I'll just keep going. And then you start talking. Like, we screwed this up so badly. It doesn't matter. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out.